out her hand, smiling, if for nothing more than the man's exuberant good nature. Though older, he was but slightly changed. The same fine clothes, the same stocky body, the same rosy countenance. That fellow at the door there didn't want to let me in until I paid him. I knew it was you, all right. Say, you've got a great show. You do your part fine. I knew you would. I just happened to be passing tonight and thought I'd drop in for a few minutes. I saw your name on the program, but I didn't remember it until you came on the stage. Then it struck me all at once. Say, you could have knocked me down with a feather. That's the same name you used out there in Chicago, isn't it? Yes, answered Carrie mildly, overwhelmed by the man's assurance. I knew it was the moment I saw you. Well, how have you been, anyhow? Oh, very well, said Carrie, lingering in her dressing room. She was rather dazed by the assault. How have you been? Me? Oh, fine. I'm here now. Is that so? Said Carrie. Yes, I've been here for 6 months. I've got charge of a branch here. How nice. Well, when did you go on the stage anyhow? Inquired Drouet. About 3 years ago, said Carrie. You don't say so. Well, sir, this is the first time I've heard of it. I knew you would, though. I always said you could act, didn't I? Carrie smiled. Yes, you did, she said. Well, you do look great, he said. I never saw anybody improve so. You're taller, aren't you? Me? Oh, a little, maybe. He gazed at her dress, then at her hair, where a becoming hat was set jauntily, then into her eyes, which she took all occasion to avert. Evidently, he expected to restore their old friendship at once and without modification. Well, he said, seeing her gather up her purse, handkerchief, and the like, preparatory to departing, I want you to come out to dinner with me, won't you? I've got a friend out here. Oh, I can't, said Carrie. Not tonight. I have an early engagement tomorrow. Aw, let the engagement go. Come on. I can get rid of him. I want to have a good talk with you. No, no, said Carrie. I can't. You mustn't ask me any more. I don't care for a late dinner. Well, come on and have a talk then, anyhow. Not tonight, she said, shaking her head. We'll have to talk some other time. As a result of this, she noticed a shade of thought pass over his face, as if he were beginning to realize that things were changed. Good nature dictated something better than this for one who had always liked her. You can come around to the hotel tomorrow, she said, as sort of penance for error. You can take dinner with me. All right, said Drouet, brightening. Where are you stopping? At the Waldorf, she answered, mentioning the fashionable hostelry then but newly erected. What time? Well, come at 3, said Carrie pleasantly. The next day Drouet called, but it was with no especial delight that Carrie remembered her appointment. However, seeing him, handsome as ever after his kind, and most genially disposed, her doubts as to whether the dinner would be disagreeable were swept away. He talked as volubly as ever. They put on a lot of lugs here, don't they? Was his first remark. Yes, they do, said Carrie. Genial egotist that he was, he went at once into a detailed account of his own career. I'm going to have a business of my own pretty soon, he observed in one place. I can get backing for $200,000. Carrie listened most good-naturedly. Say, he said suddenly, where is Hurstwood now? Carrie flushed a little. He's here in New York, I guess, she said. I haven't seen him for some time. Drouet mused for a moment. He had not been sure until now that the ex-manager was not an influential figure in the background. He imagined not, but this assurance relieved him. It must be that Carrie had got rid of him, as well she ought, he thought. A man always makes a mistake when he does anything like that, he observed. Like what? Said Carrie, unwitting of what was coming. Oh, you know, and Drouet waved her intelligence, as it were, with his hand. No, I don't, she answered. What do you mean? Why, that affair in Chicago, the time he left. I don't know what you are talking about, said Carrie. Could it be he would refer so rudely to Hurstwood's flight with her? Oh-ho, said Drouet incredulously. You knew he took $10,000 with him when he left, didn't you? What? Said Carrie. You don't mean to say he stole money, do you?
Why, said Drouet, puzzled at her tone, you knew that, didn't you?
Why, no, said Carrie. Of course I didn't.
Well, that's funny, said Drouet. He did, you know. It was in all the newspapers.
How much did you say he took? Said Carrie.
$10,000. I heard he sent most of it back afterward, though.
Carrie looked vacantly at the richly carpeted floor. A new light was shining upon all the years since her enforced flight. She remembered now 100 things that indicated as much. She also imagined that he took it on her account. Instead of hatred springing up, there was a kind of sorrow generated. Poor fellow. What a thing to have had hanging over his head all the time. At dinner, Drouet, warmed up by eating and drinking and softened in mood, fancied he was winning Carrie to her old-time good-natured regard for him. He began to imagine it would not be so difficult to enter into her life again, high as she was. Ah, what a prize, he thought. How beautiful, how elegant, how famous. In her theatrical and Waldorf setting, Carrie was to him the all-desirable.
Do you remember how nervous you were that night at the Avery? He asked.
Carrie smiled to think of it.
I never saw anybody do better than you did then, Cad, he added ruefully as he leaned an elbow on the table. I thought you and I were going to get along fine those days.
You mustn't talk that way, said Carrie, bringing in the least touch of coldness.
Won't you let me tell you?
No, she answered, rising. Besides, it's time I was getting ready for the theater. I have to leave you. Come now.
Oh, stay a minute, pleaded Drouet. You've got plenty of time.
No, said Carrie gently. Reluctantly, Drouet gave up the bright table and followed. He saw her to the elevator, and standing there said,
When do I see you again?
Oh, sometime, possibly, said Carrie. I'll be here all summer. Good night.
The elevator door was open. Good night, said Hurstwood as she rustled in.
Then he strolled sadly down the hall, all his old longing revived, because she was now so far off. The merry frou-frou of the place spoke all of her. He thought himself hardly dealt with. Carrie, however, had other thoughts. That night it was that she passed Hurstwood, waiting at the casino, without observing him. The next night, walking to the theater, she encountered him face to face. He was waiting, more gaunt than ever, determined to see her if he had to send in word. At first, she did not recognize the shabby, baggy figure. He frightened her, edging so close, a seemingly hungry stranger. Carrie, he half whispered, can I have a few words with you? She turned and recognized him on the instant. If there ever had lurked any feeling in her heart against him, it deserted her now. Still, she remembered what Drouet said about his having stolen the money.
Why, George, she said, what's the matter with you?
I've been sick, he answered. I've just got out of the hospital. For God's sake, let me have a little money, will you?
Of course, said Carrie, her lip trembling in a strong effort to maintain her composure. But what's the matter with you, anyhow? She was opening her purse and pulled out all the bills in it, a 5 and 2 2s.
I've been sick, I told you, he said peevishly, almost resenting her excessive pity. It came hard to him to receive it from such a source.
Here, she said, it's all I have with me.
All right, he answered softly. I'll give it back to you some day.
Carrie looked at him while pedestrians stared at her. She felt the strain of publicity.
So did Hurstwood.
Why don't you tell me what's the matter with you? She asked, hardly knowing what to do. Where are you living?
Oh, I've got a room down in the Bowery, he answered. There's no use trying to tell you here. I'm all right now.
He seemed in a way to resent her kindly inquiries. So much better had fate dealt with her.
Better go on in, he said. I'm much obliged, but I won't bother you any more.
She tried to answer, but he turned away and shuffled off toward the east.
For days, this apparition was a drag on her soul before it began to wear partially away. Drouet called again, but now he was not even seen by her. His attentions seemed out of place. "I'm out," was her reply to the boy. So peculiar, indeed, was her lonely, self-withdrawing temper that she was becoming an interesting figure in the public eye. She was so quiet and reserved. Not long after, the management decided to transfer the show to London. A second summer season did not seem to promise well here.
"How would you like to try subduing London?" asked her manager one afternoon.
"It might just be the other way," said Carrie.
"I think we'll go in June," he answered.
In the hurry of departure, Hurstwood was forgotten. Both he and Drouet were left to discover that she was gone. The latter called once and exclaimed at the news. Then he stood in the lobby, chewing the ends of his mustache. At last he reached a conclusion. The old days had gone for good. "She isn't so much," he said, but in his heart of hearts he did not believe this. Hurstwood shifted by curious means through a long summer and fall. A small job as janitor of a dance hall helped him for a month. Begging, sometimes going hungry, sometimes sleeping in the park, carried him over more days. Resorting to those peculiar charities, several of which, in the press of hungry search he accidentally stumbled upon, did the rest. Toward the dead of winter, Carrie came back, appearing on Broadway in a new play, but he was not aware of it. For weeks he wandered about the city begging, while the fire sign announcing her engagement blazed nightly upon the crowded street of amusements. Drouet saw it, but did not venture in. About this time, Ames returned to New York. He had made a little success in the West, and now opened a laboratory in Worcester Street. Of course he encountered Carrie through Mrs. Vance, but there was nothing responsive between them. He thought she was still united to Hurstwood, until otherwise informed. Not knowing the facts, then, he did not profess to understand and refrained from comment. With Mrs. Vance, he saw the new play and expressed himself accordingly. "She ought not to be in comedy," he said. "I think she could do better than that." One afternoon they met at the Vance's accidentally and began a very friendly conversation. She could hardly tell why the one-time keen interest in him was no longer with her. Unquestionably, it was because at that time he had represented something which she did not have, but this she did not understand. Success had given her the momentary feeling that she was now blessed with much of which he would approve. As a matter of fact, her little newspaper fame was nothing at all to him. He thought she could have done better by far. "You didn't go into comedy drama after all," he said, remembering her interest in that form of art. "No," she answered, "I haven't so far." He looked at her in such a peculiar way that she realized she had failed. It moved her to add, "I want to, though." "I should think you would," he said. "You have the sort of disposition that would do well in comedy drama." It surprised her that he should speak of disposition. Was she, then, so clearly in his mind? "Why?" she asked. "Well," he said, "I should judge you were rather sympathetic in your nature." Carrie smiled and colored slightly. He was so innocently frank with her that she drew nearer in friendship. The old call of the ideal was sounding. "I don't know," she answered, pleased, nevertheless, beyond all concealment. "I saw your play," he remarked. "It's very good."
"I'm glad you liked it."
"Very good indeed," he said, "for a comedy." This is all that was said at the time, owing to an interruption, but later they met again. He was sitting in a corner after dinner, staring at the floor, when Carrie came up with another of the guests. Hard work had given his face the look of one who is weary. It was not for Carrie to know the thing in it which appealed to her.
"All alone," she said.
"I was listening to the music."
"I'll be back in a moment," said her companion, who saw nothing in the inventor. Now he looked up in her face, for she was standing a moment while he sat.
Isn't that a pathetic strain? He inquired, listening.
Oh, very, she returned, also catching it, now that her attention was called.
Sit down, he added, offering her the chair beside him. They listened a few moments in silence, touched by the same feeling, only hers reached her through the heart. Music still charmed her, as in the old days.
I don't know what it is about music, she started to say, moved by the inexplicable longings which surged within her. But it always makes me feel as if I wanted something.
Yes, he replied. I know how you feel.
Suddenly he turned to considering the peculiarity of her disposition, expressing her feelings so frankly.
You ought not to be melancholy, he said. He thought a while, and then went off into a seemingly alien observation, which, however, accorded with their feelings.
The world is full of desirable situations, but, unfortunately, we can occupy but one at a time. It doesn't do us any good to wring our hands over the far-off things. The music ceased, and he arose, taking a standing position before her, as if to rest himself.
Why don't you get into some good, strong comedy drama, he said.
He was looking directly at her now, studying her face. Her large, sympathetic eyes and pain-touched mouth appealed to him as proofs of his judgment.
Perhaps I shall, she returned.
That's your field, he added.
Do you think so?
Yes, he said, I do. I don't suppose you're aware of it, but there is something about your eyes and mouth which fits you for that sort of work.
Carrie thrilled to be taken so seriously. For the moment, loneliness deserted her. Here was praise which was keen and analytical.
It's in your eyes and mouth, he went on abstractedly. I remember thinking the first time I saw you that there was something peculiar about your mouth. I thought you were about to cry.
How odd, said Carrie, warm with delight. This was what her heart craved.
Then I noticed that that was your natural look, and tonight I saw it again. There's a shadow about your eyes, too, which gives your face much this same character. It's in the depth of them, I think.
Carrie looked straight into his face, wholly aroused.
You probably are not aware of it, he added.
She looked away, pleased that he should speak thus, longing to be equal to this feeling written upon her countenance. It unlocked the door to a new desire. She had cause to ponder over this until they met again, several weeks or more. It showed her that she was drifting away from the old ideal which had filled her in the dressing rooms of the Avery stage and thereafter for a long time. Why had she lost it?
I know why you should be a success, he said another time, if you had a more dramatic part. I've studied it out.
What is it? Said Carrie.
Well, he said, as one pleased with a puzzle, the expression in your face is one that comes out in different things. You get the same thing in a pathetic song or any picture which moves you deeply. It's a thing the world likes to see because it's a natural expression of its longing.
Carrie gazed without exactly getting the import of what he meant.
The world is always struggling to express itself, he went on. Most people are not capable of voicing their feelings. They depend upon others. That is what genius is for. One man expresses their desires for them in music, another one in poetry, another one in a play. Sometimes nature does it in a face. It makes the face representative of all desire. That's what has happened in your case.
He looked at her with so much of the import of the thing in his eyes that she caught it. At least she got the idea that her look was something which represented the world's longing. She took it to heart as a creditable thing until he added, "That puts a burden of duty on you. It so happens that you have this thing. It is no credit to you. That is, I mean, you might not have had it. You paid nothing to get it. But now that you have it, you must do something with it."
What? Asked Carrie.
I should say turn to the dramatic field. You have so much sympathy and such a melodious voice. Make them valuable to others.
It will make your powers endure. Carrie did not understand this last. All the rest showed her that her comedy success was little or nothing.
What do you mean? She asked.
Why, just this. You have a quality in your eyes and mouth and in your nature. You can lose it, you know. If you turn away from it and live to satisfy yourself alone, it will go fast enough. The look will leave your eyes. Your mouth will change. Your power to act will disappear. You may think they won't, but they will. Nature takes care of that.
He was so interested in forwarding all good causes that he sometimes became enthusiastic, giving vent to these preachments. Something in Carrie appealed to him. He wanted to stir her up.
I know, she said absently, feeling slightly guilty of neglect.
If I were you, he said, I'd change.
The effect of this was like roiling helpless waters. Carrie troubled over it in her rocking chair for days.
I don't believe I'll stay in comedy so very much longer, she eventually remarked to Lola.
Oh, why not? Said the latter.
I think, she said, I can do better in a serious play.
What put that idea in your head?
Oh, nothing, she answered. I've always thought so.
Still, she did nothing, grieving. It was a long way to this better thing, or seemed so, and comfort was about her. Hence the inactivity and longing.
47. The Last Chapter. The Way of the Beaten. A Harp in the Wind. In the city at that time, there were a number of charities similar in nature to that of the captain's, which Hurstwood now patronized in a like unfortunate way. One was a convent mission house of the Sisters of Mercy in 15th Street, a row of red brick family dwellings, before the door of which hung a plain wooden contribution box, on which was printed the statement that every noon a meal was given free to all those who might apply and ask for aid. This simple announcement was modest in the extreme, covering, as it did, a charity so broad. Institutions and charities are so large and so numerous in New York that such things as this are not often noticed by the more comfortably situated. But to one whose mind is upon the matter, they grow exceedingly under inspection. Unless one were looking up this matter in particular, he could have stood at 6th Avenue and 15th Street for days around the noon hour and never have noticed that out of the vast crowd that surged along that busy thoroughfare, there turned out, every few seconds, some weather-beaten, heavy-footed specimen of humanity, gaunt in countenance and dilapidated in the matter of clothes. The fact is nonetheless true, however, and the colder the day, the more apparent it became. Space and a lack of culinary room in the mission house compelled an arrangement which permitted of only 25 or 30 eating at one time, so that a line had to be formed outside and an orderly entrance effected. This caused a daily spectacle, which, however, had become so common by repetition during a number of years that now nothing was thought of it. The men waited patiently, like cattle, in the coldest weather, waited for several hours before they could be admitted. No questions were asked, and no service rendered. They ate and went away again, some of them returning regularly day after day the winter through. A big motherly-looking woman invariably stood guard at the door during the entire operation and counted the admissible number. The men moved up in solemn order. There was no haste and no eagerness displayed. It was almost a dumb procession. In the bitterest winter, this line was to be found here. Under an icy wind, there was a prodigious slapping of hands and a dancing of feet. Fingers and the features of the face looked as if severely nipped by the cold. A study of these men in broad light proved them to be nearly all of a type. They belonged to the class that sit on the park benches during the endurable days and sleep upon them during the summer nights. They frequent the Bowery and those down at the Heels' east side streets where poor clothes and shrunken features are not singled out as curious.
They are the men who are in the lodging house sitting rooms during bleak and bitter weather, and who swarm about the cheaper shelters, which only open at 6 in a number of the Lower East Side streets. Miserable food, ill-timed and greedily eaten, had played havoc with bone and muscle. They were all pale, flabby, sunken-eyed, hollow-chested, with eyes that glinted and shone, and lips that were a sickly red by contrast. Their hair was but half attended to, their ears anemic in hue, and their shoes broken in leather and run down at heel and toe. They were of the class which simply floats and drifts, every wave of people washing up one, as breakers do driftwood upon a stormy shore. For nearly a quarter of a century, in another section of the city, Fleischmann, the baker, had given a loaf of bread to anyone who would come for it to the side door of his restaurant at the corner of Broadway and 10th Street at midnight. Every night during 20 years, about 300 men had formed in line, and at the appointed time marched past the doorway, picked their loaf from a great box placed just outside, and vanished again into the night. From the beginning to the present time, there had been little change in the character or number of these men. There were two or three figures that had grown familiar to those who had seen this little procession pass year after year. Two of them had missed scarcely a night in 15 years. There were about 40, more or less, regular callers. The remainder of the line was formed of strangers. In times of panic and unusual hardships, there were seldom more than 300. In times of prosperity, when little is heard of the unemployed, there were seldom less. The same number, winter and summer, in storm or calm, in good times and bad, held this melancholy midnight rendezvous at Fleischmann's breadbox. At both of these two charities, during the severe winter which was now on, Hurstwood was a frequent visitor. On one occasion it was peculiarly cold, and finding no comfort in begging about the streets, he waited until noon before seeking this free offering to the poor. Already at 11 o'clock of this morning, several such as he had shambled forward out of 6th Avenue, their thin clothes flapping and fluttering in the wind. They leaned against the iron railing which protects the walls of the 9th Regiment Armory, which fronts upon that section of 15th Street, having come early in order to be first in. Having an hour to wait, they at first lingered at a respectful distance, but others coming up, they moved closer in order to protect their right of precedence. To this collection, Hurstwood came up from the west out of 7th Avenue and stopped close to the door, nearer than all the others. Those who had been waiting before him but farther away now drew near, and by a certain stolidity of demeanor, no words being spoken, indicated that they were first. Seeing the opposition to his action, he looked sullenly along the line, then moved out, taking his place at the foot. When order had been restored, the animal feeling of opposition relaxed. "Must be pretty near noon," ventured one. "It is," said another. "I've been waiting nearly an hour." "Gee, but it's cold." They peered eagerly at the door where all must enter. A grocery man drove up and carried in several baskets of eatables. This started some words upon grocery man and the cost of food in general.
"I see meat's gone up," said one.
"If there was a war, it would help this country a lot." The line was growing rapidly. Already there were 50 or more, and those at the head, by their demeanor, evidently congratulated themselves upon not having so long to wait as those at the foot. There was much jerking of heads and looking down the line.
"It don't matter how near you get to the front, so long as you're in the first 25, commented one of the first 25. "You all go in together."
"Humph," ejaculated Hurstwood, who had been so sturdily displaced. "This here single tax is the thing," said another. "There ain't going to be no order till it comes." For the most part there was silence, gaunt men shuffling, glancing, and beating their arms. At last the door opened, and the motherly-looking sister appeared. She only looked in order. Slowly the line moved up, and one by one passed in until 25 were counted. Then she interposed a stout arm, and the line halted, with 6 men on the steps. Of these, the ex-manager was one. Waiting thus, some talked, some ejaculated concerning the misery of it, some brooded, as did Hurstwood. At last he was admitted, and having eaten, came away, almost angered because of his pains in getting it. At 11 o'clock of another evening, perhaps 2 weeks later, he was at the midnight offering of a loaf, waiting patiently. It had been an unfortunate day with him, but now he took his fate with a touch of philosophy. If he could secure no supper, or was hungry late in the evening, here was a place he could come. A few minutes before 12, a great box of bread was pushed out, and exactly on the hour, a portly, round-faced German took position by it, calling, "Ready?" The whole line at once moved forward, each taking his loaf in turn and going his separate way. On this occasion, the ex-manager ate his as he went, plodding the dark streets in silence to his bed. By January, he had about concluded that the game was up with him. Life had always seemed a precious thing, but now constant want and weakened vitality had made the charms of earth rather dull and inconspicuous. Several times, when fortune pressed most harshly, he thought he would end his troubles, but with a change of weather, or the arrival of weather, or the arrival of a quarter or dime, his mood would change and he would wait. Each day he would find some old paper lying about and look into it to see if there was any trace of Carrie, but all summer and fall he had looked in vain. Then he noticed that his eyes were beginning to hurt him, and this ailment rapidly increased until, in the dark chambers of the lodgings he frequented, he did not attempt to read. Bad and irregular eating was weakening every function of his body. The one recourse left him was to doze when a place offered and he could get the money to occupy it. He was beginning to find, in his wretched clothing and meager state of body, that people took him for a chronic type of bum and beggar. Police hustled him along. Restaurant and lodging house keepers turned him out promptly the moment he had his due. Pedestrians waved him off. He found it more and more difficult to get anything from anybody. At last he admitted to himself that the game was up. It was after a long series of appeals to pedestrians in which he had been refused and refused, everyone hastening from contact. "Give me a little something, will you, mister?" he said to the last one. "For God's sake, do. I'm starving." "Ah, get out," said the man, who happened to be a common type himself. "You're no good. I'll give you nothing." Hurstwood put his hands, red from cold, down his pockets. Tears came into his eyes. "That's right," he said. "I'm no good now. I was all right. I had money. I'm going to quit this." And with death in his heart, he started down toward the Bowery. People had turned on the gas before and died. Why shouldn't he? He remembered a lodging house where there were little close rooms with gas jets in them, almost prearranged, he thought, for what he wanted to do, which rented for 15 cents. Then he remembered that he had no 15 cents. On the way he met a comfortable-looking gentleman coming clean-shaven out of a fine barber shop. "Would you mind giving me a little something?" he asked this man boldly. The gentleman looked him over and fished for a dime. Nothing but quarters were in his pocket. "Here," he said, handing him one to be rid of him. "Be off now." Hurstwood moved on, wondering. The sight of the large, bright coin pleased him a little. He remembered that he was hungry and that he could get a bed for 10 cents. With this, the idea of death passed, for the time being, out of his mind. It was only when he could get nothing but insults that death seemed worthwhile. One day in the middle of the winter, the sharpest spell of the season set in. It broke gray and cold in the first day, and on the second snowed. Poor luck pursuing him. He had secured but 10 cents by nightfall, and this he had spent for food. At evening he found himself at the boulevard in 67th Street, where he finally turned his face Boweryward. Especially fatigued because of the wandering propensity which had seized him in the morning, he now half-dragged his wet feet, shuffling the soles upon the sidewalk. An old thin coat was turned up about his red ears. His cracked derby hat was pulled down until it turned them outward. His hands were in his pockets. "I'll just go down Broadway," he said to himself. When he reached 42nd Street, the fire signs were already blazing brightly. Crowds were hastening to dine. Through bright windows, at every corner, might be seen gay companies in luxuriant restaurants. There were coaches and crowded cable cars. In his weary and hungry state, he should never have come here. The contrast was too sharp. Even he was recalled keenly to better things. "What's the use?" he thought. "It's all up with me. I'll quit this." People turned to look after him, so uncouth was his shambling figure. Several officers followed him with their eyes to see that he did not beg of anybody. Once he paused in an aimless, incoherent sort of way and looked through the windows of an imposing restaurant, before which blazed a fire sign, and through the large plate windows of which could be seen the red and gold decorations, the palms, the white napery, and shining glassware, and above all, the comfortable crowd. Weak as his mind had become, his hunger was sharp enough to show the importance of this. He stopped stock still, his frayed trousers soaking in the slush, and peered foolishly in.
"Eat," he mumbled. "That's right. Eat. Nobody else wants any."
Then his voice dropped even lower, and his mind half lost the fancy it had.
"It's mighty cold," he said. "Awful cold."
At Broadway and 39th Street was blazing, in incandescent fire, Carey's name. "Carey Medenda," it read, "and the Casino Company." All the wet, snowy sidewalk was bright with this radiated fire. It was so bright that it attracted Hurstwood's gaze. He looked up, and then at a large, gilt-framed poster board on which was a fine lithograph of Carey, life-size. Hurstwood gazed at it a moment, snuffling and hunching one shoulder as if something were scratching him. He was so run down, however, that his mind was not exactly clear.
"That's you," he said at last, addressing her. "Wasn't good enough for you, was I?"
He lingered, trying to think logically. This was no longer possible with him.
"She's got it," he said incoherently, thinking of money. "Let her give me some."
He started around to the side door. Then he forgot what he was going for and paused, pushing his hands deeper to warm the wrists. Suddenly it returned. The stage door, that was it. He approached that entrance and went in. "Well," said the attendant, staring at him. Seeing him paused, he went over and shoved him. "Get out of here," he said.
"I want to see Miss Medenda," he said.
"You do, eh?" the other said, almost tickled at the spectacle. "Get out of here!" And he shoved him again. Hurstwood had no strength to resist.
"I want to see Miss Medenda," he tried to explain, even as he was being hustled away. "I'm all right, I..."
The man gave him a last push and closed the door. As he did so, Hurstwood slipped and fell in the snow. It hurt him, and some vague sense of shame returned. He began to cry and swear foolishly.
"Goddamn dog," he said. "Damned old cur,"
wiping the slush from his worthless coat.
I hired such people as you once."
Now a fierce feeling against Carey welled up, just one fierce, angry thought before the whole thing slipped out of his mind.
"She owes me something to eat," he said. "She owes it to me."
Hopelessly, he turned back into Broadway again and slopped onward and away, begging, crying, losing track of his thoughts one after another, as a mind decayed and disjointed is wont to do. It was truly a wintry evening, a few days later, when his one distinct mental decision was reached. Already at 4 o'clock, the somber hue of night was thickening the air. A heavy snow was falling, a fine picking, whipping snow, borne forward by a swift wind in long, thin lines. The streets were bedded with it, 6 inches of cold, soft carpet, churned to a dirty brown by the crush of teams and the feet of men. Along Broadway, men picked their way in ulsters and umbrellas. Along the Bowery, men slouched through it with collars and hats pulled over their ears. In the former thoroughfare, businessmen and travelers were making for comfortable hotels. In the latter, crowds on cold errands shifted past dingy stores, in the deep recesses of which lights were already gleaming. There were early lights in the cable cars, whose usual clatter was reduced by the mantle about the wheels. The whole city was muffled by this fast thickening mantle. In her comfortable chambers at the Waldorf, Carrie was reading at this time Père Goriot, which Ames had recommended to her. It was so strong, and Ames's mere recommendation had so aroused her interest, that she caught nearly the full sympathetic significance of it. For the first time, it was being borne in upon her how silly and worthless had been her earlier reading as a whole. Becoming wearied, however, she yawned and came to the window, looking out upon the old winding procession of carriages rolling up Fifth Avenue. "Isn't it bad?" she observed to Lola. "Terrible," said that little lady, joining her. "I hope it snows enough to go sleigh riding." "Oh, dear," said Carrie, with whom the sufferings of Father Joriot were still keen. "That's all you think of. Aren't you sorry for the people who haven't anything tonight?"
"Of course I am," said Lola. "But what can I do? I haven't anything."
Carrie smiled. "You wouldn't care if you had," she returned.
"I would, too," said Lola. "But people never gave me anything when I was hard up."
"Isn't it just awful?" said Carrie, studying the winter storm.
"Look at that man over there," laughed Lola, who had caught sight of someone falling down. "How sheepish men look when they fall, don't they?"
"We'll have to take a coach tonight," answered Carrie absently. In the lobby of the Imperial, Mr. Charles Drouet was just arriving, shaking the snow from a very handsome ulster. Bad weather had driven him home early and stirred his desire for those pleasures which shut out the snow and gloom of life. A good dinner, the company of a young woman, and an evening at the theater were the chief things for him. "Why, hello, Harry," he said, addressing a lounger in one of the comfortable lobby chairs. "How are you?"
"Oh, about 6 and 6," said the other.
"Rotten weather, isn't it?"
"Well, I should say," said the other. "I've been just sitting here thinking where I'd go tonight."
"Come along with me," said Drouet. "I can introduce you to something dead swell."
"Who is it?" said the other.
"Oh, a couple of girls over here in 40th Street. We could have a dandy time. I was just looking for you.
Supposing we get 'em and take 'em out to dinner?"
"Sure," said Drouet. "Wait till I go upstairs and change my clothes."
"Well, I'll be in the barber shop," said the other. "I want to get a shave."
"All right," said Drouet,
creaking off in his good shoes toward the elevator. The old butterfly was as light on the wing as ever. On an incoming vestibuled Pullman, speeding at 40 miles an hour through the snow of the evening, were 3 others, all related.
"First call for dinner in the dining car," a Pullman servitor was announcing as he hastened through the aisle in snow-white apron and jacket.
"I don't believe I want to play any more," said the youngest, a black-haired beauty turned supercilious by fortune as she pushed a euchre hand away from her.
"Shall we go into dinner?" inquired her husband, who was all that fine raiment can make.
Oh, not yet, she answered. I don't want to play any more, though.
Jessica, said her mother, who was also a study in what good clothing can do for age, push that pin down in your tie. It's coming up. Jessica obeyed, incidentally touching at her lovely hair and looking at a little jewel-faced watch. Her husband studied her, for beauty, even cold, is fascinating from one point of view.
Well, we won't have much more of this weather, he said. It only takes 2 weeks to get to Rome.
Mrs. Hurstwood settled comfortably in her corner and smiled. It was so nice to be the mother-in-law of a rich young man, one whose financial state had borne her personal inspection.
"Do you suppose the boat will sail promptly?" asked Jessica, "if it keeps up like this?"
"Oh, yes," answered her husband. "This won't make any difference." Passing down the aisle came a very fair-haired banker's son, also of Chicago, who had long eyed this supercilious beauty. Even now he did not hesitate to glance at her, and she was conscious of it. With a specially conjured show of indifference, she turned her pretty face wholly away. It was not wifely modesty at all. By so much was her pride satisfied.
At this moment, Hurstwood stood before a dirty four-story building in a side street quite near the Bowery, whose one-time coat of buff had been changed by soot and rain. He mingled with a crowd of men, a crowd which had been and was still gathering by degrees. It began with the approach of two or three, who hung about the closed wooden doors and beat their feet to keep them warm. They had on faded derby hats with dents in them. Their misfit coats were heavy with melted snow and turned up at the collars. Their trousers were mere bags, frayed at the bottom and wobbling over big soppy shoes, torn at the sides and worn almost to shreds. They made no effort to go in, but shifted ruefully about, digging their hands deep in their pockets and leering at the crowd and the increasing lamps. With the minutes increased the number. There were old men with grizzled beards and sunken eyes, men who were comparatively young but shrunken by diseases, men who were middle-aged. None were fat. There was a face in the thick of the collection which was as white as drained veal. There was another red as brick. Some came with thin, rounded shoulders, others with wooden legs, still others with frames so lean that clothes only flapped about them. There were great ears, swollen noses, thick lips, and above all, red, bloodshot eyes. Not a normal, healthy face in the whole mass. Not a straight figure. Not a straightforward, steady glance. In the drive of the wind and sleet, they pushed in on one another. There were wrists, unprotected by coat or pocket, which were red with cold. There were ears, half-covered by every conceivable semblance of a hat, which still looked stiff and bitten. In the snow they shifted, now one foot, now another, almost rocking in unison. With the growth of the crowd about the door came a murmur. It was not conversation, but a running comment directed at anyone in general. It contained oaths and slang phrases. "By damn, I wish they'd hurry up. Look at that copper watchin'. Maybe it ain't winter, nuther. I wish I was in Sing Sing." Now a sharper lash of wind cut down, and they huddled closer. It was an edging, shifting, pushing throng. There was no anger, no pleading, no threatening words. It was all sullen endurance, unlightened by either wit or good fellowship. A carriage went jingling by with some reclining figure in it. One of the men nearest the door saw it. "Look at the bloke riding. He ain't so cold." "Eh, eh, eh," yelled another, the carriage having long since passed out of hearing. Little by little the night crept on. Along the walk a crowd turned out on its way home. Men and shop girls went by with quick steps. The crosstown cars began to be crowded. The gas lamps were blazing, and every window bloomed ruddy with a steady flame. Still the crowd hung about the door, unwavering.
"Ain't they ever going to open up?"
queried a hoarse voice, suggestively. This seemed to renew the general interest in the closed door, and many gazed in that direction. They looked at it as dumb brutes look, as dogs paw and whine and study the knob. They shifted and blinked and muttered, now a curse, now a comment. Still they waited, and still the snow whirled and cut them with biting flakes. On the old hats and peaked shoulders it was piling. It gathered in little heaps and curves, and no one brushed it off. In the center of the crowd, the warmth and steam melted it, and water trickled off hat rims and down noses, which the owners could not reach to scratch. On the outer rim, the piles remained unmelted. Hurstwood, who could not get in the center, stood with head lowered to the weather and bent his form. A light appeared through the transom overhead. It sent a thrill of possibilities through the watchers. There was a murmur of recognition. At last the bars grated inside and the crowd pricked up its ears. Footsteps shuffled within, and it murmured again. Someone called, "Slow up there now," and then the door opened. It was push and jam for a minute, with grim beast silence to prove its quality, and then it melted inward like logs floating and disappeared. There were wet hats and wet shoulders, a cold, shrunken, disgruntled mass pouring in between bleak walls. It was just 6 o'clock, and there was supper in every hurrying pedestrian's face, and yet no supper was provided here, nothing but beds. Hurstwood laid down his 15 cents and crept off with weary steps to his allotted room. It was a dingy affair, wooden, dusty, hard. A small gas jet furnished sufficient light for so rueful a corner. He said, clearing his throat and locking the door. Now he began leisurely to take off his clothes, but stopped first with his coat and tucked it along the crack under the door. His vest he arranged in the same place. His old, wet, cracked hat he laid softly upon the table. Then he pulled off his shoes and lay down. It seemed as if he thought a while, for now he arose and turned the gas out, standing calmly in the blackness, hidden from view. After a few moments, in which he reviewed nothing but merely hesitated, he turned the gas on again, but applied no match. Even then he stood there, hidden wholly in that kindness which is night, while the uprising fumes filled the room. When the odor reached his nostrils, he quit his attitude and fumbled for the bed. "What's the use?" he said weakly, as he stretched himself to rest. And now Carrie had attained that which in the beginning seemed life's object, or at least such fraction of it as human beings ever attain of their original desires. She could look about on her gowns and carriage, her furniture and bank account. Friends there were, as the world takes it, those who would bow and smile in acknowledgement of her success. For these she had once craved. Applause there was, and publicity, once far-off, essential things, but now grown trivial and indifferent. Beauty also, her type of loveliness, and yet she was lonely. In her rocking chair she sat, when not otherwise engaged, singing and dreaming. Thus in life there is ever the intellectual and the emotional nature, the mind that reasons and the mind that feels. Of one come the men of actions, generals and statesmen, of the other the poets and dreamers, artists all. As harps in the wind, the latter respond to every breath of fancy, voicing in their moods all the ebb and flow of the ideal. Man has not yet comprehended the dreamer any more than he has the ideal. For him the laws and morals of the world are unduly severe. Ever hearkening to the sound of beauty, straining for the flash of its distant wings, he watches to follow, wearying his feet in traveling. So watched Carrie, so followed, rocking and singing.
And it must be remembered that reason had little part in this. Chicago dawning, she saw the city offering more of loveliness than she had ever known, and instinctively, by force of her moods alone, clung to it. In fine raiment and elegant surroundings, men seemed to be contented. Hence she drew near these things. Chicago, New York, Drouet, Hurstwood, the world of fashion and the world of stage, these were but incidents. Not them, but that which they represented, she longed for. Time proved the representation false. Oh, the tangle of human life! How dimly, as yet, we see. Here was Carrie, in the beginning poor, unsophisticated, emotional, responding with desire to everything most lovely in life, yet finding herself turned as by a wall. Laws to say, be allured, if you will, by everything lovely, but draw not nigh unless by righteousness. Convention to say, you shall not better your situation save by honest labor. If honest labor be unremunerative and difficult to endure, if it be the long, long road which never reaches beauty but wearies the feet and the heart, if the drag to follow beauty be such that one abandons the admired way, taking rather the despised path leading to her dreams quickly, who shall cast the first stone? Not evil, but longing for that which is better more often directs the steps of the erring. Not evil, but goodness more often allures the feeling mind unused to reason. Amid the tinsel and shine of her state walked Carrie unhappy. As when Drouet took her, she had thought, now I am lifted into that which is best. As when Hurstwood seemingly offered her the better way, now I am happy. But since the world goes its way past all who will not partake of its folly, she now found herself alone. Her purse was open to him whose need was greatest. In her walks on Broadway, she no longer thought of the elegance of the creatures who passed her. Had they more of that peace and beauty which glimmered afar off, then were they to be envied. Drouet abandoned his claim and was seen no more. Of Hurstwood's death, she was not even aware. A slow black boat, setting out from the pier at 27th Street upon its weekly errand, bore, with many others, his nameless body to the Potter's Field. Thus passed all that was of interest concerning these twain in their relation to her. Their influence upon her life is explicable alone by the nature of her longings. Time was when both represented for her all that was most potent in earthly success. They were the personal representatives of a state most blessed to attain, the titled ambassadors of comfort and peace, aglow with their credentials. It is but natural that when the world which they represented no longer allured her, its ambassadors should be discredited. Even had Hurstwood returned in his original beauty and glory, he could not now have allured her. She had learned that in his world, as in her own present state, was not happiness. Sitting alone, she was now an illustration of the devious ways in which one who feels, rather than reasons, may be led in the pursuit of beauty. Though often disillusioned, she was still waiting for that halcyon day when she should be led forth among dreams become real. Ames had pointed out a farther step, but on and on beyond that, if accomplished, would lie others for her. It was forever to be the pursuit of that radiance of delight which tints the distant hilltops of the world. Oh, Carrie, Carrie! Oh, blind strivings of the human heart! Onward, onward, it saith, and where beauty leads, there it follows. Whether it be the tinkle of a lone sheep bell or some quiet landscape, or the glimmer of beauty in sylvan places, or the show of soul in some passing eye, the heart knows and makes answer, following.
It is when the feet weary and hope seems vain that the heartaches and the longings arise. Know, then, that for you is neither surfeit nor content. In your rocking chair, by your window dreaming, shall you long, alone. In your rocking chair, by your window, shall you dream such happiness as you may never feel. This concludes the reading of Sister Carrie by Theodore Dreiser. This book was originally published in United States in 1900. This unabridged recording of Sister Carrie was produced in 1999 by Blackstone Audiobooks Incorporated, which holds the copyright there too. Neither this recording nor any portion of it may be reproduced or used for any purpose without prior written authorization from Blackstone Audiobooks. This book was read by C.M. Hebert. If you would like to obtain a mail-order catalog or additional information about our growing line of audiobooks, call 1-800-SAY-BOOK. That's 1-800-729-2665. Thank you.